The American Academy of Pediatrics and other leading medical groups are suing Robert F. Kennedy Jr. after the Health and Human Services Secretary changed some vaccine recommendations. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about the lawsuit, the new recommendations, and what this could mean for the availability of vaccines are Richard Hughes, the attorney for the medical groups that filed suit. Thanks for being here, Richard.
Thanks so much for having me.
And immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Chris Peltier. Welcome back, Dr. Peltier.
Thanks, Lucy. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Richard, explain this lawsuit. Which organizations are behind it and why are they suing?
Sure. So we brought suit on behalf of several major medical groups, and that includes the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Physicians, the Society of Maternal Fetal Medicine, Infectious Diseases Society of America, as well as the Massachusetts Public Health Alliance and a pregnant patient, Jane Doe. We brought this suit because what we want to do is put an end to Secretary Kennedy's really unfortunate actions, behaviors that amount to efforts, a pattern of efforts to destroy vaccine access and vaccine confidence in this country. And so we bring this suit specifically asking court to reverse his decision to override the recommendations of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices with respect to COVID recommendations, vaccine recommendations for pregnant women and children. And we expect that, you know, if he continues to engage in further unlawful actions that injure our clients or others, that we expect to amend our complaint.
And Richard, explain a little bit more about this specific policy or decision that made your clients decide to file this suit.
Sure. So, you know, there have been many actions on the part of the secretary that are very suspect, just a steady stream. So we saw the rescheduling of the first meeting of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices at the CDC. At the beginning of the year, we've seen him remove all of its members. The highly qualified, distinguished experts on that panel were removed. They were replaced with a very questionable slate of individuals who are mostly anti-vaccine, and a number of other actions that really do undermine vaccine policy. But this one in particular was one that would constitute what we call in administrative law a final agency action when he released the video with the heads of NIH and FDA and said, you don't need to get the COVID vaccine anymore. We're going to change the recommendation. He didn't follow any processes, any procedures. They did not take a hard look at legitimate science and evidence when they made that decision. And that's what we call arbitrary and capricious. And that's unlawful. You can't make decisions that way. And so that's what we're challenging.
And Dr. Peltier, talk a little bit more about what these changing vaccine recommendations from the federal government are. Richard just mentioned the COVID vaccine.
Sure. So, you know, and Richard was correct. So, you know, this really, I think, came to an head with the video announcement that Richard referenced. Let's back up and just talk a little bit about the process of what happens when a vaccine is sort of developed. So, you know, vaccines go through testing. There's four different phases of testing for vaccines, where they really start with animal models, and then they start phase one and two with a very small sort of adult population where they're tested really for safety. They then increase that to start to look at, you know, effectiveness. Does it produce antibody response and protect against disease? Then we get into some of the phase three trials, which are a lot larger, which are going to then really, when we're talking about pediatric vaccines, are going to really start to include children. New vaccines are tested against the current sort of FDA-approved vaccines, if one is available. And then once those tests are completed, the manufacturers submit that application to the FDA. The FDA then will or will not grant approval. If it's granted approval, it then would go to the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, that Richard mentioned, which in previously for the past 40 years has really been made up of a group of pediatricians, infectious disease experts, epidemiologists, vaccine researchers, that then really look at all of the data that's out there to determine, is the vaccine safe? Is it effective? And there have been times where the ACIP has said, look, there is not enough evidence for us to recommend approving this vaccine, or that may not be safe. Once that ACIP group makes its recommendation, it then goes to the CDC for final approval. And then ultimately, the Secretary of Health and Human Services gets the sort of the ultimate say. So, as Richard mentioned, they're as a pediatrician, very worried about the loss of some of the voices that were in the room for ACIP being replaced. There's currently only one pediatrician now on that group. The group was cut in half. And there are many people that have had sort of held long sort of vaccine skeptical or anti-vaccine attitudes and policies that they've been trying to push. The most recent ACIP meeting that did take place, really, it centered around a couple of recommendations. One of them was actually very positive, and I'm going to say it looked at approval of a new monoclonal antibody immunization to protect against RSV or respiratory syncytial virus. We've had 2 years now where another product was available, and this is a new product that will be on the market, very similar to the one that was currently available. But they agreed that immunization should be allowed and approved. So that was that. The other thing that they really did was they focused on influenza vaccine. And they did, again, kudos, recommend, influenza vaccine. However, they spent a lot of time looking at an ingredient that is found in some multi-dose vials of vaccine. So when you order vaccines, my office gets vaccines, we can either get a single dose vial, right, which is just, it's already drawn up, it's a single dose, we inject it, or it can come in a vial that contains usually 10 doses, and our nurses will, can drop 10 doses in a row from that. And to prevent anything from bacteria growing in that vial, sometimes there are preservatives, and one of those preservatives is thimerosal, which was really looked at 25 years ago. It was brought up, could there be some concern with mercury? There has never been any evidence that has been found or shown that thimerosal causes any damage when used in a vaccine. But the ACIP decided to take a large amount of time and really saying that they should not have any vaccines with thimerosal, despite the lack of evidence that there really is no harm to it. And honestly, the fact that most vaccines don't have thimerosal in them anyway. So it was a lot of sort of time and brain energy spent on an issue that was really sort of inconsequential.
I want to let our listeners know we're talking about new vaccine recommendations from Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., if you're just joining us, and a lawsuit that leading medical organizations have filed against him. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And Dr. Peltier, you covered a lot of ground there, which I appreciate. We'll dig into some more specifics of all that as we talk. But what about this change in guidance as far as COVID-19 vaccines? What did the federal government, do about that?
Yeah, so it's a little confusing because, as Richard said, Secretary Kennedy came out and said that COVID vaccine would no longer be routinely recommended for children or pregnant moms. Then a few days later, I believe it was the CDC came and said, no, we really are not going to do that. So I think we're a little bit in limbo. And the biggest issue with that is, number one, when ACIP does not recommend a vaccine, that is a signal to insurance companies that they don't have to pay for that vaccine, which means that there may be families, patients, children that want to get the COVID-19 vaccine and won't be able to pay for it because their insurance no longer covers it. The other big issue is that almost half of the vaccines in this country are given through a federally funded, state-run program called the Vaccine for Children's Fund, or VFC, which grants vaccines at no cost to children that are on Medicaid or children who have no insurance at all. And one of the requirements for being on VFC is that the vaccine is ACIP approved for that age group. So again, with there sort of being ambiguity and not certain, is this going to be a recommended vaccine? You really run the risk of not being able to afford it or not being able to get it at all.
Richard, is that one of the concerns that the parties you're representing have, that, you know, the confusion or lack of an ACIP recommendation could have consequences for whether health insurance covers certain vaccines or whether they're provided through this this free program that Dr. Peltier just was talking about?
Well, it certainly is. You know, the ACIP has played a central role in making these recommendations and in coordination with the various professional societies for 61 years. And what's happened over time is that Congress and the states have really created a lot of reliance through public policy on the ACIP. So you take the Affordable Care Act, we tied the preventive services coverage requirement, which means that payers have to provide vaccines at zero out of pocket to patients. We tied that to ACIP. We did the same thing with the Inflation Reduction Act for seniors who have the prescription drug benefit, Part D and Medicare. Same thing, no out-of-pocket costs for recommended vaccines. As Chris mentioned, the Vaccines for Children program, which we've had for now around 31 years, as Chris said, half the children in the country get access through that program. At the state level, pharmacists' scope of practice, pharmacies are a huge side of care, and you know, that's a really important access point where in some states, because of the way the state has structured its law or its policy, it could mean that the pharmacist may not automatically be able to administer the vaccine. School requirements, you know, that's something that is that's determined at the state level. And it has been for a very long time, you know, that it's the federal government does not mandate vaccines for school entry, but states look to the ACIP. So those are just a handful of examples of where policy starts to disintegrate. And you'll see if you look at the complaint that we filed on Monday, that there are a number of instances that we mentioned in there, and that creates direct injuries for providers and for patients, you know, providers who are unable to practice medicine in the way that they are supposed to be able to do in accordance with standards of care, and then for patients who just are encountering access barriers.
We're going to continue our conversation after a short break. If you've got questions or comments about these new vaccine recommendations and what's happening with the Department of Health and Human Services, you can give us a call. The number is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And later in the program, we'll discuss parvovirus and how it's on the rise locally. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about changing vaccine recommendations and a new lawsuit against Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. My guests are Richard Hughes, the attorney for the medical groups that filed that lawsuit, and immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Chris Peltier. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Peltier, before our break, you were talking about how vaccines go through this rigorous development process. They're tested for efficacy and safety. Can you talk just a little bit more about how vaccines are tested?
Oh, sure. I would be happy to. So, the very first trials are very small. They're typically called phase one trials. This is after they've been studied, usually in an animal model. They then will recruit usually healthy adults, and they're really testing safety, to make sure that there's no untoward outcome from the vaccine. They then will move up to what's called a phase two trial, which usually will involve more patients, sometimes pediatric patients, depending on the vaccine and the study. And not only are they looking for safety, but they're beginning to look for, does the vaccine do what it's supposed to? You know, the way most vaccines work is that a piece of the infectious agent, be it a bacteria or a virus, or in some cases, a live virus that's been weakened to the point that it does not cause disease, but will sort of cause your body's immune system to develop antibodies against that. So when your body does come into contact with either that bacteria or that virus in the real world, you're protected against it. Then, as long as things continue, and at various times, manufacturers have to submit their sort of ongoing data to the FDA. Sometimes studies are paused if there might be a safety concern. The FDA reviews that, will suggest, they will make the manufacturer institute changes if they deem necessary. They then would move on to phase three studies, which are, again, much larger. These are studies that are going to involve lots of children, looking, again, at safety and does the vaccine work. And then sometimes there's even phase four trials, which are often done after post-marketing to really sort of see, if there's any untoward side effects. And you know, my practice, we've been doing vaccine trials for over 20 years now. And really what usually happens when a family enrolls in a vaccine trial is, number one, it's voluntary, right? We get informed consent and they can withdraw that at any time. Most of the time, you know, if there's a company trying to make a new vaccine where there's already a similar vaccine on the market, it's usually what we call blinded. So there's a 50-50 chance that your child would either get the currently licensed vaccine or the study vaccine. They are then looking for, again, safety and side effects. So several days after the child gets the immunization, the parent will keep a diary. You know, did the child have any fever? Was there redness at the site of the injection? Did they have any fevers? And then most of the time in many of these studies, as they're looking to see, is the vaccine effective? There are blood draws. Also, again, looking for safety concerns. Was there any issue, you know, to the kidneys or the liver? And then drawing antibody profiles to look and see, did the vaccine actually create antibody levels that are at the same level as the vaccine that's currently on the market? Mm-hmm. Again, after all of those studies are done, and if it, the company feels like, yes, the vaccine's safe, and yes, it worked, they then would submit an application to the FDA. Very vigorous process where the FDA would review all of the study, the data from all of those studies. And again, sometimes it can take up to 20 years to develop a vaccine. Mm. The FDA approves it, then it would still be an experimental vaccine. It would then go, as we said, to the ACIP, who would, you know, in years past, review all of that data, make a recommendation. Again, the ACIP does not always approve or recommend vaccines. There have been times where they have not. If they approve it, it then goes to the CDC for final sign-off. And then that vaccine would become recommended, which means, as Richard was saying, you know, through the ACA and through the VFC program, it would then be covered. No out-of-cost payments for families or for children getting those vaccines.
We did get a couple questions from listeners. We got an email from Barbara who asks, is there a source, group, or site that provides accurate and scientific information about vaccines, feeling like the government sites are not going to be as accurate at this time? Dr. Peltier, are there particular sites that you're recommending to patients or friends who are asking about this?
There are. So first and foremost, I would recommend the American Academy of Pediatrics. They have a parent-facing site. It's healthychildren.org, and they have lots of up-to-date information about vaccines. And in fact, the AAP has, in recent weeks talked about, you know, continuing to publish their own immunization schedule, which has almost always been based on ACIP recommendations, but now thinking about, do different medical organizations together need to come together to produce their own recommendations for vaccines? The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia also has a fantastic vaccine education site. I recommend that. And then there's also another site, it's called the Immunization Coalition, and they have very credible scientific-based information on vaccines.
We also got an email from Michelle who writes, childhood vaccines are life-saving, especially for kids with chronic diseases. What recommendations do the panelists have for parents who are concerned and want to get involved? Richard, do you have any thoughts on that?
First, I would just really reinforce what Chris said. It's incredibly important that we look to those professional societies, because I think the American people trust their providers, right? And we want to really emphasize the importance of working with your healthcare provider, working with your pediatrician to understand vaccine science, to understand the guidelines. As Chris said, there are consumer-friendly resources, but there are also the guidelines, and all of that is public and available. And I think just making science, vaccine safety understandable for the public is really important. And so word of mouth among parents, I think, is just incredibly important within your community, to be having conversations to say, you know, that is what you heard there is incorrect. Here's a resource. And I think really trying to meet people where they are, in the sense that we're not dismissive of people's concerns. If someone is genuinely asking questions and concerned and not just sort of trying to be a source of misinformation, it's really important to look them in the eye, try to understand where they're coming from, and to share real information, real science. I think that's just so incredibly important. And then at the state and the local level, we continue to see anti-vaccine advocacy activities, legislation every year. And so it's just really important that there's engagement with lawmakers. Lawmakers need to hear from their constituents. They need to understand how vaccine-preventable diseases impact the community. It's one thing for me or for Chris to talk about the great success broadly of vaccines, but when you can really say that, you know, this community needs to maintain, you know, this number of vaccinated people in order for it to be safe from, you know, say, measles, that's really compelling to a lawmaker. It's really important that we're fulfilling that role as citizens.
You know, Richard, we've been talking about the importance of this advisory council known as the ACIP, the different roles that it plays in this work and with the federal government, what insurance covers. You know, some people would argue, well, RFK Jr., he's the Health and Human Services Secretary. Can't he appoint whoever he wants to these boards? I mean, what about that?
Sure. You know, the secretary has a lot of legal authority. And, you know, there was a Supreme Court decision just a couple of weeks ago, Braidwood now is retitled. And, you know, I actually worked with some groups that supported the position in that case, because we wanted to maintain the integrity of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and its role in setting recommendations that have to be covered. We said, you know, we agree with the secretary. He should be able to exercise some control over that committee so that we can still have good policies. That was a very double-edged sword. But you really had this affirmation that the secretary does have the authority to make the final call. And that's just a part of the reality of our system of government and our law, is that the secretary has this authority. But he can't simply wield it any way he wishes. He can't come into office with all of his bias and lots of pretext and lots of misinformation and disinformation and lots of half-truths and, you know, tweeting about non-existent studies or trying to sort of create imaginary correlations to suggest that vaccines cause certain, you know, adverse outcomes. That's all extremely dishonest. To run roughshod over processes and procedures like those that have been developed through the ACIP for 61 years, you know, these actions are unlawful. So it's really a separate question as to whether he has that authority or not, and how he wields that authority. And that's really what the suit is about, is how is he wielding that authority?
And Dr. Peltier, what are the risks for children, for families, if young children don't get these vaccines, even the COVID vaccine or the flu shot, or if pregnant women don't get those shots? I mean, what are the risks posed by that?
I'm really glad you asked that question, and it's a very timely question. And in fact, I think the last time I was on with you, we discussed measles. And unfortunately, we're going to talk about measles again today. So there was just an article that came out today in the New York Times that measles cases have hit an all-time record high since 2000, when really measles was declared eliminated in the United States, which is very scary. As we talked about on that episode a couple of months ago, right? Measles is not a benign illness. You can end up in the hospital. You can have severe neurologic complications with it, and measles can ultimately result in death. And so, you know, that's an extreme case, but that's the reality that we're looking at. And unfortunately, with sort of the chaos and the uncertainty that's sort of being dispelled around vaccines, I fear that we're going to see more and more of this, of parents not understanding the importance of vaccines. Again, you know, we live in a time where, until recently, right, many of the illnesses that pediatricians 40, 50, 60 years ago were dealing with on a routine basis that were killing children, we don't see anymore. And there's one reason: the most single effective public health sort of effort in this country has been vaccines. So, you know, we run the risk of resurgence of things like measles and other viruses that and bacteria that really have been close to be eliminated.
Well, I've been talking with Richard Hughes, the attorney for the medical groups that filed suit against Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Thank you so much for your time today, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
And I've also been talking with immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Chris Peltier. He is going to stay with us. Thanks for doing that, Chris. Up next, parvovirus is on the rise locally. We'll discuss what you need to know. This is Cincinnati Edition.